Thank you, Greg. I am thrilled to be backstage with our soloist, Garrick Olson. Garrick, what a powerful performance. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It is remarkable that this Barber Concerto has not been performed on subscription with the Philadelphia Orchestra for almost four decades when John Browning performed it here. How does it feel to be bringing back this piece to Philadelphia with the orchestra in Verizon Hall?
Well, of course it feels great. I mean, it feels great to play anything with this orchestra here, especially because, after all, Barber is more or less a local composer, and a very great one, and a composer who's perhaps fallen into more neglect than one could have imagined. I'm surprised that the piece isn't more popular because it's utterly successful in every way, shape, and form. It's dramatic, it's melodic, it's exciting, it's effective, it's even, the public likes it. And I just thought that this piece would be right up there with the Rachmaninoff second and the Tchaikovsky one.
Well, I think the technical challenges seem immense. I mean, it seems incredibly difficult not only to perform, also the ensemble playing and memorizing a piece of this scope. Could you talk about that?
It is very difficult, of course. It's incredibly well written. In other words, they're terribly difficult, but they sound incredible. I mean, you get tremendous return, which you don't always get, say, in Brahms, where some of the most difficult things are barely observable to the public at large because they don't know how you're turning yourself into a pretzel but not making a lot of noise while you do it. You do need, as a soloist, to know the orchestra part intimately. And, of course, the piece is full of excitement but a certain kind of mid-20th century angst. There is some terror here and there in the atmosphere, so that can actually provoke you to sort of feel a little terrorized. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the question of memory, which I love to talk about because it's such a real one. Memory is important. It's not necessarily an artistic quality. It's a character, I think, that has to do with your genetics and perhaps a little bit with your training. To play a piece like The Barber, when you hear an incredibly brilliant passage and go sort of to yourself, oh, wow, wasn't that, that must be so difficult. In order to play a passage like that, you probably, let's say, for argument's sake, have to practice it. By the 175th time you've practiced it and still can't play it, you've memorized it. So what I like to say as a joke is that, well, you could be impressed that I memorized it. You should be much more impressed that I can actually play it because that's a much greater accomplishment.
The concerto was somewhat criticized at its premiere in 1962 for being conservative, but oddly to our ears today, at least to mine, where there's been a shift back to tonality, it doesn't seem that conservative.
I think you're right. I would agree with you. It's interesting how style and fashion changes in music. Barber, like Rachmaninoff, was not among the most progressive composers of his times, but he was not among the most regressive either. But we have come a long way since then. We've been through neoclassicism, neoromanticism, minimalism, all these isms, 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 isms. And now it's an open field for composers because really you're not judged by the language in which you compose. You're more judged by the quality or effectiveness of the music you've written. So I think Barber scores very, very high on all those things. Your choice of musical language does not determine the quality of the piece.
Speaking of musical language, let's talk for a minute about that middle movement, the canzone. It's so lushly lyrical. Is this Samuel Barber's true heart?
I think so, because in every piece of Barber, no matter how challenging, including this one, there are these moments of unabashed romanticism. So, yeah, I think that is Barber's true heart, because he returns to that kind of heart in all of his works at one point or the other, and some of them are much more romantic even than this. I can't speak for him. I only met him once, but I would say for me, yes.
Finally, you're taking on a huge project now, playing the complete solo piano works of Johannes Brahms over two seasons. Brahms to Barber to Rachmaninoff and all the other repertoire you're playing. How do you mentally switch gears for all that?
The thing is, just like memorization, there are great artists, musical artists, who learn slowly, and there's those who learn quickly, and those learn in between. So the ability to have a large repertory, once again, is not an artistic quality. Better you should play a few things and play them really well than to play a lot of things and have them pretty good. I like the stimulation. I like challenges still. I've never wanted to be a pianist who just had sort of a traveling repertory of things I play, hopefully exquisitely. To quote the great Sviatoslav Richter in one of his rare interviews, he said, I don't feel quite all right if I'm not learning a new piece almost every day. And I don't know why. Somehow it's engaging part of myself. So luckily I've had enough success and the opportunities to do such things. And happily I'll be playing the first program of my Brahms series in Philadelphia in March.
We can't wait for that. Garrick Olson, thank you so much. It was great inspiration speaking with you, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.